Hey, I'd like to direct everybody to the link below. That is where you can buy the ebook for just $4.99. It's on Smashwords. Smash. Pick it up. Separation of Business and State. Everyone that got the book already, for a higher price, they're going to get a free update and some little goodies, which I'll be talking about in a little bit. It's all going to be worth it, and hopefully we'll get the paper version out sometime, maybe this summer. Now, I did an hour-long interview about 9/11. Audio is a little scratchy in the beginning, but it was nice to have a platform since I can't go on Jonestown or any of the sensationalist channels. I have to do everything on my own and promote everything myself. But it was a nice interview. Got into the anthrax, Iraq war, and my take on 9/11. And if you haven't seen War by Deception, you should check that out. And that's linked below, too. And it's free.
Work and just a brief introduction to yourself.
Well, my work is mostly geopolitical analyst. As a geopolitical analyst, I cover topics mostly on the Middle East, sometimes Japan, sometimes Africa. I get all over the place. I've made some documentaries. The most famous one was probably War by Deception, which is about the 9/11 terrorist attacks and the Iraq war and anthrax, all of the above. It was a long 3-hour and 40-minute movie to begin with. I crunched it down to about 2 hours later on. And then I've made a documentary called Decades of Deception, which goes over about 60 years of horrible things that the CIA has done. And I've been writing articles and blogging and doing my YouTube and going on television appearances and radio shows for about 13 years.
Well, good for you, man. I had you on because I want to talk to you about your film, War by Deception, on the 9/11 attacks, because I recently watched your condensed version, and I found a lot of the content very compelling. You provide a lot of information and substance and basically things that I'd never heard before, and I thought that you would make a very interesting guest. So if you don't mind, why don't you kind of break down your analysis of the attacks that happened on September 11, 2001, your research leads you to believe is responsible, and the failings that you find in what I would characterize as the mainstream 9/11 truth movement.
I call them 9/11 kook movement. There's a lot of films about 9/11, and they all sort of have a nexus point, an origin point, in a place I call Jonestown, which is an old melon head, loudmouth in Texas, who took 9/11 and basically set up the framing on it to where everyone is obsessing about how fast the buildings came down or whether or not Larry Silverstein said pull it and what that means, and just a bunch of minutia that doesn't really matter, and the leaving off the Iraq war, where over a million people are dead, which to me is a much greater crime than just the attacks on the towers. And is also...
All right, well, why don't you get into why, what your research led you to, has led you.
The big thing that's missing is how the attacks on September 11th were erroneously attached to Iraq and used as propaganda to start a war there as well as Afghanistan. I mean, the wars were the main purpose. The point of it was to replace the Cold War with the War on Terror, which is a war on a tactic, an unending war that can never be won. The reality is these terrorist cells, you can look today in Syria, the al-Nusra Front, or MEK in Iran, or Jandala, or, you know, name a terrorist group. They're privateer cells of our own CIA, as was the Mujahideen and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, had worked hand in glove with the CIA. Sometimes they work with NATO, which we've seen in Ukraine.
Just people who may not know what you mean, what are profiteers?
Well, they're profiteers and privateers. And a privateer, back in the day, there used to be pirates. Pirates were terrorists on the water because they're sort of stateless bandits that go around robbing boats and attacking ships and stealing goods for themselves. A privateer is different than a pirate because a privateer had secret state backing. So the British were the best at this, or I guess they're the English at the time. They would secretly finance pirates because the main power of the sea for a long time was Spain. And there's no way England's going to take an English ship and attack a Spanish ship because that would start a war. However, the Spanish are controlling the Caribbean and they're getting all these goods from the New World and the English are very envious. But one way they could attack them would be with pirates, because if a pirate gets caught, the only thing the Spanish can do is have a trial and hang the pirate, or even not even have a trial, just kill the pirate. But they can't really have it go back to the English or the French or whoever is actually sponsoring the pirate. And so that's a way of financing terrorists to attack your enemies, and yet it doesn't go back to you. Another thing you can do is attack yourself in a sort of false flag. Use your own privateer to attack yourself and then go, aha, see what they did, and then attack a less powerful enemy. And that's what we have today, is the same kind of system, except rather than being on the sea, it's anywhere. And they're still privateers. And so you have a group like the Mujahideen, which the United States and through the CIA and the ISI in Pakistan had a rent-a-terrorist group. I mean, Al-Qaeda were foreign fighters from anywhere. They weren't even Afghanis. And attacked the Soviets in Afghanistan, but not directly. It wasn't the United States fighting the Russians. It was the Mujahideen fighting the Russians with American weapons and American money and American training, and as well as training from Pakistan and money from Pakistan too. And then money from Saudi Arabia with the Bin Ladens, which is a large construction firm at the time. And the Bin Ladens, Tim Osman, who is also known as Osama Bin Laden, was working for Bush's father. Bush's father was the head director of the CIA and then vice president, and then he became the president. And that relationship lasted the entire time. And so that has to be called into question when Al-Qaeda is suddenly attacking the United States. You've got to look at these terrorists and see that they've always got state backing. And it's not Afghanistan. I'm talking about other state backing. And you see the United States and Israel and the United Kingdom use these groups all the time. And you saw the United States do this in Iran-Contra in tandem with the Israelis. Iran-Contra was a massive scandal in the 80s. It busted wide open in 1986 because of a CIA plane crashed filled with weapons and drugs in Nicaragua. Because what they were doing is they were selling illegal drugs to finance. And the reason they have to finance it like this is they need black market, off-the-book type of money, because the CIA can't really go to Congress and say, hey, we'd like X amount of money to go overthrow a country. You can't do it like that. So what they did is they were financing the Contras to fight the Sandinistas by selling drugs and illegal weapons, and bringing the weapons in there and training them and giving them the guns to fight against a leftist government that they didn't approve of. And they got caught red-handed, and Oliver North got up in trial and said, well, you know, we didn't tell the president about it because we needed plausible deniability. And all that means is you got to have layers between yourself and the man on the top, so that if the operation does go sour, they're protected from it. And that's how they fight through these layers. And that's happening today. You don't have to go back to the 80s. That's happening today in Syria, where the U.S. through Saudi Arabia and Turkey are financing known terrorists, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda al-Kuk, and al-Nusra, all in Syria, in a massive civil war, which doesn't benefit the United States at all. These are based on Israeli policy papers from Oded Yanan, who also wrote them up in the 80s, to destabilize Syria. And they don't even want a winner. The whole goal is to get Shiites and Sunnis to kill each other, because that's a win-win for the Israelis, and they completely run U.S. foreign policy. Now, getting back to 9/11, it's the same players and same methods. You have the Israelis and U.S. intelligence working together with their own privateers to create an event
which would be used to launch wars for Israel, such as the war in Iraq, and for massive military profiteering, for people to make money off the war. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, Halliburton, all the giant corporations who you saw go up as much as 30% because of the Iraq war and the war in Afghanistan, which had nothing to do with 9/11 or weapons of mass destruction or any of the BS that they fed the public. But what people don't remember is how that got attached to 9/11. That's what I tried to get out in the film. And you won't hear this from Jonestown or anything. They never connect the narrative, but they don't want you to know the Israeli role. In film from Jonestown, the Fabled Enemies, they had the anthrax notes up, which said death to America, death to Israel on them, blurred out death to Israel. Didn't want you to remember that or see that. But that's absolutely crucial in understanding the Iraq war, because Americans were pissed off after 9/11. They wanted to blow someone up. Everyone had their little Made in China yellow magnets on the back of their SUVs that said support the troops and so on, and they wanted to just take it out on somebody. And the media kept saying Bin Laden Hussein, Bin Laden Hussein, as if they were the same person. But officially, the legal reason for the war in Iraq was that they were violating a UN resolution 1441, which stated that they couldn't have these weapons of mass destruction. And they had several different lies about WMDs. One of them was about anthrax and VX gas. And why did they think they had anthrax? And why did they think they had anthrax that they passed to Al-Qaeda? Well, that came from, the story about the anthrax came from Judith Miller, who was a New York Times writer who blamed everything on Iraq. They blamed the first World Trade Center bombing on Iraq. She blamed Oklahoma City on Iraq. So, of course, she was going to blame 9/11 on Iraq. But she's the one that said that they had these mobile weapon labs where they were producing anthrax and VX gas.
All right, who is this Judith Miller lady? Why don't you go into her a little bit?
She's a New York Times writer. She was also the girlfriend of Lewis Scooter Libby, who was Dick Cheney's chief of staff, hardcore Zionist. Lewis Libby was a lawyer for the Mossad agent Mark Rich. Mark Rich, who's involved in Iran-Contra, also involved with the Russian oligarchs and child trafficking and every crime you can imagine. He was a real loser. Him and Pincus Green got busted. He was on Interpol's most wanted list, a notorious worldwide criminal. And Bill Clinton gave him a pardon his last day in office. And because his wife, Denise Rich, financed Hillary Clinton's Senate campaign in New York. That's another story. But his lawyer was Dick Cheney's chief of staff. You see how this crosses both parties. It doesn't matter. But
no, the main parties are all bought and paid for.
They are. Well, Lewis Libby and Miller were working together to lie about Iraq. Now, there's this leftist narrative that blames the Iraq war on oil, which is completely bull. We didn't get the oil. We already had the oil in this thing called the Oil for Food Program, which was set up between the two Iraq wars. The first Iraq war was based on lies, too, this myth about babies on incubators.
That was debunked ages ago.
Yes, it was. And the thing is, if you say, look, there wasn't an event where there was babies on incubators, that was BS. It doesn't mean you hate Kuwait, and it doesn't mean you support Saddam. It just means you support the truth. That was a lie. And if that was your reason, your emotional motivation to go bomb and kill 500,000 children yourself, then you have to realize that there weren't any babies on incubators, but there were 500,000 children starved to death in Iraq because of the sanctions. But there's this leftist narrative about oil. And the thing is, we did not go to war for oil. We didn't get the oil. We didn't even try. The oil companies did not push for the war. The war was started for Israel. There was an office set up inside the Pentagon called the Office of Special Plans under Douglas Feith, who's also a hardcore Zionist. He worked with Feith and Zell. Mark Zell is an Israeli settler in Palestine. A settler is a nice word for ethnic cleansing racial colonist. And they got a bunch of contracts during the war, but Douglas Feist set up this office within an office, specifically with the purpose to cherry-pick intelligence or fabricate it in order to get a war with Iraq. And he was set up, the chairman for the Defense for Policy, Richard Perle, helped him set up this office. Paul Wolfowitz contributed to it, as did Lewis Libby. And these guys are all part of this group called the Project for New American Century. The media outfit for that was called the Weekly Standard, which was run by William Kristol and Robert Kagan. Robert Kagan's wife is Victoria Nuland, the one that said FU to the EU and started this shit in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
Well, Robert Kagan and William Kristol are the ones who are going to publish. They're going to be the mouthpiece for the PNAC group. And PNAC is an Israeli think tank, really. That's what it is. It's a Project for New American Century, but their real goals are Israeli hegemony.
Well, I've skimmed through the Rebuilding American Defenses document, and basically, yeah, they just want a very aggressive American-led foreign policy. Now, why don't we get into like some of the
See, these guys published a paper in July before September 11th happened that had Osama bin Laden's face in the middle of it in an article talking about anthrax attacks. So they were writing about all of this before it happened.
Focus on the anthrax attacks, and then I want to go back to what actually happened on September 11th. The kind of the evidence that generally a lot of people don't know. Kind of just go into the events of September 11th.
Oh yeah, there are people caught with bombs. I mean, if you're not going to talk about that, you're definitely trying to avoid something on purpose. But let me run through the anthrax real quick, because that is vital. There was an anthrax attack after 9/11. And everyone assumed it was Al-Qaeda because they signed it and said September 11th on the top of the notes. And it was sent from the areas where the hijacker cells allegedly had been in Joaquin, New Jersey, as well as Florida. Now, the ones in Florida, those notes weren't opened until later, but they were identical to the ones in Jersey. So it was before there was any reporting on it. Therefore, whoever sent the notes in New Jersey had to be the same person or know the people who sent them in Florida. It all got blamed on this guy named Bruce Ivins, who conveniently was suicided before he ever had a trial. But there's no way he could have been in both places at once and showed back up at work in Maryland. And he physically couldn't have done it. And that's proven. You can Google it. And that case was never really resolved. But at first, it was blamed on Al-Qaeda. And then it was blamed on Iraq. Because these guys in PNAC, Gary Schmidt, who's getting the story from James Woolsey, who's a CIA Zionist, retired, Gary Schmidt writes in Kagan's publication that the Iraqis met in Prague with Mohammed Atta. He was already building a case where Mohammed Atta, who was on Flight 11 that ran into the World Trade Center, who's the lead hijacker, had met with senior Iraqi officials in Prague. So why is he meeting with these Iraqis? They're like, oh, it couldn't have been done. It could not have been done without state backing. Well, they got that right. And so they're like, the state that was backing him was Iraq, because Iraqi officials were meeting with Mohammed Atta in Prague. He couldn't say anything about the anthrax yet, because even though it had been mailed, it hadn't been opened yet, because a lot of the mail got shut down because a lot of the flights were shut down after 9/11. They grounded all the airplanes, the stock market shut down, a lot of things went into lockdown. But somebody tried to mail anthrax to a couple U.S. senators to kill them. Patrick Leahy, who's on the Judicial Committee, the chair of it, and could shut down the Patriot Act, and would have too. He had opposed it, and the other was the Tom Daschle. And the two senators against the Iraq War and against the Patriot Act, who were trying to be a little calm and less reactionary,
hello, you there?
Murder them.
Oh yes. Yeah.
And
Mr. Dawson, is he trying to get him back up?
I'm here.
That holds definitely a wealth of information. He definitely has his names and dates down. Very well.
Did I lose you on Skype there for a second?
Let's see. Yeah, I lost you. I lost you for a second, but you're back. There we go.
I was saying, okay, they sent these anthrax to Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy, two senators who were against the Patriot Act and opposing the war in Iraq. They were being a little bit more calm. They're also in positions to kill it. Leahy was and Dashiell were in chairman-type positions where they could crush these things from getting rammed through. Remember, the Patriot Act had been pre-written, and you've got Zionist senators like Joe Lieberman, you know, yelling their head off trying to get it rammed through, and they would succeed. But they had not lied about anthrax yet. They had lied about Atta meeting Iraqi officials, but they couldn't say anything about anthrax until the anthrax letters were actually opened. So they had to wait another month because a lot of these, this was lost in the mail or had been grounded because a lot of flights were grounded on 9/11. And there was just a flood of mail, especially the congressmen and senators. And it ended up other people were opening it. And people died from these attacks too. They sent some anthrax to some journalists too. And Robert Stevens was the first to die, but once the anthrax had been opened and reported on, and the first to report on it was a paper called, from the New York Observer, owned by Charles Kushner, a hardcore Zionist Jewish billionaire in New York, who got involved in a honey trap with the governor of New Jersey, McGreevy, who was a gay governor who was sleeping with an Israeli, who he had given a six-figure salary and a job in the security for our nuclear power plant up there. But everybody remembered the scandal of, oh, the governor's gay. Who cares that he's gay? The main thing is that his boyfriend was an Israeli spy. But that honey trap was set up by the man who owned the paper who first ends up reporting about this anthrax attack. But it went back to Gary Schmidt and Pienaar, who had already written about Atta in Prague, as well as Kagan. Both of them then came out with new articles saying, aha, not only did Mohammed Atta meet Iraqi officials in Prague, he also got anthrax from them. And the source for that was Israeli security forces. And this was in European papers and U.S. papers showing that the Israelis said they witnessed the transfer of anthrax from these unnamed senior Iraqi officials to Mohammed Atta. And that officially connected 9/11 to Iraq. And Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State at the time, and the Vice President Dick Cheney went on to Tim Russert and said that they had this anthrax. And then we had the lie from Judith Miller talking about mobile weapons labs. And there weren't any mobile weapons labs. And there wasn't a meeting in Prague either. So it would have been impossible for the Israelis to have witnessed a transfer of anthrax from senior Iraqi officials to Mohammed Atta, when one, Iraq didn't have anthrax, two, Al-Qaeda didn't have anthrax, three, there wasn't even a meeting. And that's not something you can screw up, that's not incompetence, that's a conscious lie, because they claim to have witnessed an event that never took place, and it went all over the U.S. media, and they didn't care. But this was so crucial, it wasn't oil, it was weapons of mass destruction. That is the lie that was used to start the war. Colin Powell went to the UN. He's the Secretary of State. Sorry, Condoleezza Rice would later be, but
yeah.
Colin Powell went to the UN with a mock vial of anthrax and made this long speech and presentation about anthrax and VX gas from Iraq. And he included the mobile weapons lab myth in there. He had to point to a cartoon. They didn't have any pictures of the mobile weapons labs because they didn't actually exist. But he has this ridiculous cartoon picture of these trucks that could be carrying this stuff around. Guess who wrote his speech? Lewis Libby, Miller's boyfriend, Cheney's chief of staff, lawyer for the Mossad. He's the one that writes this bogus speech about the anthrax. And Colin Powell, they used him because he actually had some credibility. If one of these neocon, hardcore Zionist Israeli dual citizens got up there and said it, nobody would believe them. But they got Colin Powell to say it. And Colin Powell's sort of a mediocre guy, but he's not going to lie about something like that. And he wasn't lying. He was repeating a lie out of ignorance, out of trust.
Well, you know, I kind of want to not just take a minute, because there's always this... There's this narrative or this thing that anytime anyone is critical of Israel, that, you know, that you must have some racial motivation or anti-Semitic or neo-Nazi sympathies. And that's just simply not true. Like, I don't I've been critical of Israel in the past, but it's not based on any sort of racialism, you know.
I would say the opposite. I would say if you're not critical of Israel, you probably have some racial tribal bias or something. If you criticize North Korea, it doesn't mean you hate Koreans or you hate Asians. It just means the government in North Korea is insane. And it's the same with Israel. I mean, there's no way around it. It has nothing to do with Jewish people or anything. It's a government. It's a country, just like criticizing America. And Israel is a country that openly has ethnic cleansing. They bulldoze down people's houses. They set up Jewish-only settlements for Jews and Jews only. They segregate their high schools. They won't allow they have color-coded license plates so that Israelis have one color and can pass around on the highways. Palestinians have another color, so they can get pulled over and harassed in checkpoints. I mean, it is an apartheid worse than South Africa. It is a racist state. They have state-approved and ordained racism attached to an insane version of a religion. God-ordained, a God as a real estate agent type of in just totally batshit crazy policy to go and murder kids and destroy villages. And then set up your own and put a wall around it and an army around it and say, this land is mine. God gave it to me. That is crazy. And that ought to be criticized. But the people out there that are afraid to criticize that, that's who's actually racist. The people who want to say that you're blaming the Jews. It's not the Jews, but it is in their eyes because they don't see a difference between Israel and the Jews because a racist Jew or a racist Christian sees Israel as a Jewish state, as a race, not as a country full of people that favors a race, but as an actual race where God wants that land to be inherited by a certain like bloodline, which is nuts. But there are a lot of nutty people.
What would you say to people who are like, who would say, well, Israel has a right to defend itself?
But they're not defending themselves. They're on the offense. They're actively confiscating land and stealing it. That's not defense. You can't have it. I mean, a military occupation isn't defense. That's offense. And of course, there's a reaction from Palestinians in Gaza to desperately shooting homemade rockets into fields and never end up being able to get anybody with these things. But that's starting the story in the middle. You forgot that there's a blockade on Gaza, that they've been starving to death, that Israel routinely bombs them back in the Stone Age with F-15s and modern weaponry versus people throwing rocks and smuggled in RPGs now and then. What would you expect them? I mean, were the Jews in Warsaw terrorists against the Nazis because they threw Molotov cocktails at them? No, the Nazis were the terrorists because they're the ones that were out there ethnically cleansing Jews. Of course the Jews are going to fight back. Well, it's the same thing. Palestinians are going to fight when there's a state actively wiping them out and stealing their property, stealing their water, and murdering people and their families. Well, how else would they react? Israel's not on the defense. They're on the offense.
Okay, what do you think the appropriate measures are to resolve the conflict in that area? I know that's kind of a large question and it might be beyond your expertise, but as someone who obviously has studied this issue in depth and has a great field of a great wealth of knowledge on it, how do you see this conflict being resolved? How do you think, what is the answer between this? Because to me, it seems like it's two groups of people that have perpetually throughout history fought for this chunk of land. And you know what I mean?
They weren't fighting before 1947. There were fights, I mean, in ancient times.
But yes.
They had been living together. Jews had been living in Palestine and all throughout the Middle East without conflict until the British got involved. You could have peace negotiations, actual real peace negotiations tomorrow if Israel wanted peace. But Israel's not interested in peace. But if you wanted Israel to get interested in peace, you could do it in one day by one simple act. You cut off their foreign aid. Israel's getting over $3.5 billion with a B dollars, not as a loan, but as a gift every year from the American taxpayers. and they get a lot from Christian churches too, but they have a guaranteed annual $3.5 billion pound of flesh from the American taxpayers. And that is the money that they need, because they use a portion of that to go back through AIPAC, their lobby, and bribe Congress so that the Congress obeys the foreign policy that Israel wants to dictate. And the Congress, you say, well, if they're giving money to Congress and Congress is giving money to them, isn't that the same? No, because Congress has given your money to them and they're giving your money to Congress. It's not, Congress doesn't lose any money. They just take your money and give it to Israel, or they borrow some from the Federal Reserve and they give it to Israel. You're the one stuck having to pay that debt, not the Israelis. If you cut off the flow of money, there would be peace tomorrow.
All right.
It's really up to Americans. There's nothing the Palestinians or the Israelis can do about it. It's Americans who have to get active and say, stop sending foreign aid to Israel. It's immoral. It's used for ethnic cleansing. We give a lot of tyrants foreign aid. Paul Kagame of Rwanda, who has killed millions of Africans in the Congo. 40% of this monster's budget is foreign aid from the U.S. and the United Kingdom. But Americans have never heard of this guy, probably can't find Rwanda on a map, don't know what's happening. We've got to end foreign aid, not only to Israel, but to a lot of places where dictators are propped up by U.S. money. And
no,
the UK needs to do it too. There's not much we can do about that, but that, you know, I think they would follow suit if the Americans would pick up the ball.
I agree with that. Foreign aid, generally they say it's giving rich people in poor countries money from poor people in rich countries. Why don't we go on?
That's very true, but there's two types of foreign aid. You're talking about the predatory lending from the IMF, and that's where it's not a gift. Like, they give Israel money and then they forgive the loans.
Yeah,
there's another situation where they loan out money to a government in the third world to intentionally drive them in debt, which they know they can't pay off without, you know, hyperinflation and printing money. And the only way they can repay is to give up assets. And so they give up land. And that's how they lease land out to giant multinational, usually American-centric corporations to go in and make raw goods, take all the raw resources and turn them into finished products, mostly in African and Latin American countries, and then turn around and sell it back to them. That's the old Banana Republic type of gambit that they do. But there's foreign aid, like in Israel, where they're just giving away your money. That's not a loan, and it's not predatory lending. It's just flat out a subsidy to military industries, where through the medium of foreign aid, Israel goes and buys up 75% of the foreign aid's earmarked for U.S. weaponry. So they're really just recycling the money back on U.S. weapons, and they don't care if Palestinians or Lebanese or Egyptians get killed. I mean, they're brown. They don't count.
Well, you know, I generally think that the ruling class is a predatory, psychopathic class that really doesn't care about any of us. They live off the wealth of the sweat of our backs. So some of them are smart enough to not to want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. But other than that, I don't think there's a shred of humanity in the lot of them. But why don't we focus now on the events of September 11th? What is your research? What did you find when you talk about what you covered in your film, if you don't mind?
Well, you start seeing all those Israeli connections with the anthrax and lies about the Iraq war. And so if you rewind from there to the actual events of 9/11, do you see any of that, or do you see a CIA hand? Absolutely. For one, two of the hijackers, Al-Hazmi and Al-Midhar, who were involved in the USS Cole bombing. And if people aren't familiar with that, it was a U.S. ship that got attacked while it was in Yemen. And what was supposed to be going to Bahrain, but it stopped in Yemen anyway and suddenly got attacked. But every single person involved in that miraculously broke out of jail or got out of jail. And two of the guys, and they're on the State Department's no-fly list, but two of them who ended up becoming 9/11 hijackers flew to the United States, lived in the United States. They had their real passports, their real names. There was actually a Saudi GID agent on loan that actually was their roommate for a little while in the United States. And Nobody arrested him. And that's because Richard Blee and these guys in the CIA were protecting them. You saw the Moussaoui trial. They wanted a FISA to a warrant to search his computer. No. Bowman squashed that. They weren't allowed to look at his computer. And they've never said no to wiretapping or searching, never. Look at the NSA today. But no, when it came to an Al-Qaeda member, no, he's a member of Al-Qaeda and you want to see his computer even after September 11th, they still wouldn't look into it. That's looking the other way on purpose. And that's because they knew. They're like, yes, we know who these terrorists are. They're our terrorists. Right? So you see just stuff like that that is just inexcusable and unexplainable. But then you start seeing the Israeli role and it's everywhere. One, there's the dancing Israelis. Then you have the Israelis caught with bombs on the George Washington Bridge. And then we have Israelis busted with fake passes into the towers, into the basements of the towers, working for fake companies. And I can go over all three of those events. But the focus has always been on the dancing Israelis. Or, I mean, their focus has been not on Israel at all. But if there is any mention of it, they always focus on them because they're the least condemning of the three groups. But that doesn't even stop there. But I guess I'll start with those guys. You had a woman who witnessed three guys at Doric Towers. They're up on the roof of a parking garage filming the first plane hitting. And they were celebrating. They were jumping up and down. They were standing on the roof of their van. They're flicking lighters with the smoke in the background of the plane that had run into the World Trade Center, the North Tower. And it's odd because they've got their van there parked to look at the north side of the North Tower as if they knew not only a plane was going to hit, but what side it was going to hit. And so she called the cops. Why are these three guys celebrating? Why do they think it's so funny?
Hey, Ryan, I gotta go to a quick break because we got to change the battery in the camera. Can you hold there? We'll get back to you in 2 minutes.
Sure.
Perfect. All right, we're back. Ryan, why don't you just continue with what you were talking about before we had to switch out the battery.
Okay, well, you know, this lady thought it was really suspicious that these people were happy after a plane crash. Didn't know it was a terrorist attack yet. A lot of people thought the first crash was an accident. It wasn't until the second plane hit that they realized this was on purpose. And of course, these guys knew. They were all happy and celebrating about it. So she called the police on them. And on the side of their truck was a logo that said Urban Moving Systems. So she gave them the license plate and that description. And later on in the day, way later in the day, they'd be pulled over because the cops saw the Urban Moving System truck and the license plate, and they pulled them over. And by that time, there were five guys in the truck, not three. And of course, she had just seen the three. We know there were four of them there because the pictures we find later, somebody had to be taking them, so another one of them had to have been there. But you had Sivan Kersberg and his brother Paul Kersberg. There was Oned Eldner, Mamari, and Yarm Shmel. There's the guys who were all in this van or truck and who had been celebrating the attack. Now, they had gotten rid of the video camera. They passed it off at this place called the White Glove to a woman who had been working with them. But they still had their regular camera shots. They had 76 pictures. And we didn't know these details. We knew they'd been pulled over. We knew the story of the Israelis. And we knew that two of them had been working for the Mossad. And we knew some information right away in 2001. It was reported in the Jewish Daily Forward newspaper. It was on ABC and Army Radio and some local New Jersey papers, too. But we didn't have these details about how many pictures they took or who did what until 2011 August, when Freedom of Information Act finally got processed and we got redacted reports. Well, what I did, knowing their names from the Jewish Daily Forward and other reports, could simply count the number of letters in their name and look at the black box where their name was. And just by process of elimination, say, okay, that one's this guy, that one's this guy. You know, Ed and Eldner's got a short name, so you know who was who and pieced it all together. And it took a long time and a lot of deduction. But I matched it with other sources and reports where I knew the driver was Sivan Kersberg, because that had already been reported. First words out of his mouth, by the way, were, "We're not the problem. The Palestinians are your problem. Your problems are our problems." Blaming it on Palestinians right away. Doesn't even know what he's being arrested for. Assumes it's about 9/11 and starts blaming Palestine, which had nothing to do with September 11th. But no, were some reports that day called in where they said Palestinian bomb makers were mixing up a bomb near the airport and coming in a beige van. I don't know how the caller knew they were Palestinian. You can't really look at Arabs and say, aha, they're Palestinian. Maybe they're wearing Palestinian flags or something. But they tried to do that. But what happened was the cops cut off all the entrances, the George Washington Bridge, the Holland Tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel. They cut them all off. And instead of catching this Palestinian van, they caught this Urban Moving Systems van. Well, the Israelis didn't know that the cops were looking for them, because they didn't know that that woman had spotted them at Doric Towers and called the police. So they caught the white van with Urban Moving System on it and found these Israelis who had pictures of themselves celebrating as the towers were getting hit. They had moved from the north side of the North Tower to the south side of the South Tower in Liberty Park and filmed that also. And you can see from the pictures that they had been there from the beginning. Based on there's a helicopter in the background, which giving reports which were time stamped, and you can deduce based on its position and everything where they were. We know that they had been there at least only 5 minutes after the attack, because that's when the woman called the cops. Well, they had been there before that because they were set up and had their cameras pointed there. She just called them after they started celebrating. They didn't start celebrating until the plane hit, obviously. But given the smoke in the background and everything, they had been there before it hit. And also, they could not have gotten from their place of work up to the top level of the parking garage within 5 minutes. Plane hits, bam, we're up there and celebrating right away. They had been there. Plus, Sivan Kersberg, the driver, he had been in that same tower the day before and given some bogus excuse saying he was a maintenance person or something, but he was on an elevator with actual maintenance men who knew he was full of it. And he was pulled out of the police lineup by those people who put him in Doric Tower on September 10th. So he was already scoping it out, their vantage point and where they were going to film it from. They had passports. All of them had passports to go to different parts of the world, Germany, everywhere, you know, the following hours. I mean, they were going to leave the next day and get out of the country, and they weren't all going to the same place. They're all going to different places. And then Paul and Sivan were both Mossad agents. They're working for an Israeli intelligence. So you have Israeli intelligence operatives with all these passports to get out of town, filming the first plane hitting and celebrating the attack, and then later trying to blame it on Palestinians. But more than that, they're the owner of Urban Moving Systems, Dominic Suter, and his wife fled back to Israel immediately. And the FBI went in there and confiscated 12 computer hard drives, never did find out what was on them. But they officially listed Suter as a suspect in 9/11. And that they passed this intelligence off to other agencies. And we had copies of the Italian and Polish versions of those, which include his name, and then finally we got the English as well in the Freedom of Information Act. He's listed as a 9/11 suspect, and he was the owner. Now, Dominic Suter got $500,000 loan for his business, which is supposed to be moving furniture and stuff, only in 2001. Nothing in 2000, nothing 2002. Just in 2001, he gets $500,000 loan. And what he purchased with this were Aero trucks. Aero trucks were back in Tennessee, where FedEx is. And that's all Urban Moving System is. It's an Aero truck with a logo put on it to rent these cars out. Now, the Aero trucks were used in September 11th. An Aero truck was driven by a guy named Sakura Hamad to Tennessee from New York on 9/11. And this guy, they all got busted within months. By January of 2002, these guys would be in jail. But there's another cell of five guys who were acquiring fake IDs in Tennessee, because that's a state where you didn't need a social security number to get a driver's license at the time. And they were working with this woman in the DMV called Catherine Smith, who had bought her car from one of the guys in the cell, a man from Jerusalem named Khalid Abdallah. Catherine Smith, by the way, was killed the day before her trial. She was burned to death in her car. It was arson. They found gasoline traces in her clothing still. Witnesses saw her ablaze in her car going down the road. She was murdered, and she was the key witness in this ID fraud and could have told us a lot more information on this cell. Unfortunately, she was murdered, and you didn't see a lot of press about that.
And Khalid was the ringleader. He never spent a day in jail. The rest of them went to jail. He went back to Israel, and his main partner got bailed out for $250,000, $250,000 for a truck driver to get out of jail. But what happened was, when they went to acquire these IDs, one of them, they got busted right there. They'd been being watched. They were being watched the whole time. But they got busted in the parking lot. One of them's delivering the IDs to the rest of them. They're all waiting, and bam, they get busted together. Well, one of the guys who were waiting, another Hamad, which was Sakira's cousin, was holding in his wallet, on his person, at the time of the arrest, passes to the World Trade Center, dated September 5th, 2001, where they had been doing work in the basements. They had passes to all the lower levels of the basements of the towers. And then also on his person, he had these cards for Denko Mechanical and Magic Heating and Plumbing. Neither one of these businesses actually existed. Magic Heating and Plumbing went to an obsolete business license for a company like that, but the number for it just went to a residential address, as did Denko Mechanical for this guy named David Enko, who's a very wealthy Jewish man who also went back to Israel and denied having anything to do with it. However, I suspect he was who paid the $250,000 bail. Now, they weren't on trial for 9/11. The judge knew they were involved in it. It was serendipitous how they caught him, but they're technically on trial for the theft of IDs, so he set the bail as high as the law allowed, and it still was paid, and they just fled, and they let the underlings rot. But Denko Mechanical didn't exist, and they said, well, we were doing, working on sprinkler systems and elevators. Well, yeah, they were, but as Susan Nash of the FBI pointed out in the investigation, that the World Trade Center did everything in-house, and they did not hire out to anybody to work on the elevators. The elevators were broken. They'd been busted for over a month. Something suspicious had happened. And the elevators are staggered, but the one that went all the way from the bottom to the top had not been working for a month. Well, that's a very convenient way. If you want to put stuff all over the building, you control an elevator. You got access to every floor and can do whatever you want. I personally don't think there were bombs on every floor, but I think having access to the basements is vitally important. They definitely had explosives in the basements because they went off before the planes hit. And you have eyewitness after eyewitness in my film saying how the entire subway was filled with smoke, how the lobby had been blown apart before the collapse of the towers. And there's no way a plane can hit 94 floors above you and then knock panels off in the lobby and break the windows in the lobby. There's no way. And it's not from the elevators falling down and hitting the basement. It wasn't that big. The basement was blown out simultaneously with the trains, with the planes hitting above. And you have witness after witness talking about the explosions in the basement. And you can see live on the footage the big plume of smoke coming up from the bottom of the towers before they collapsed. And I've got all that in the film, and I've got all the witnesses in the film talking about it. And journalists who were there and people riding the subway, and you can hear the doom, 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 and they were definitely secondary explosions in the basement. So somebody had access to the basement. Here we have guys caught with a fake pass who are doing work in the basement of the towers, which we know they weren't hired to do, and getting bailed out from these rich guys in New York who are part of this fake business front. So and they're driving Arrow trucks, which were bought and paid for by somebody who had hired two Israeli intelligence agents, minimal. So you have to put all that together. And that's why Fox News, when investigating this, said, how could they not have known about it? Even if you're not blaming them for it, the Israelis certainly had foreknowledge of the attacks. And you combine that with them lying about the anthrax and mailing these notes, because they were mailed from the location of the hijacker's cells. How did they know where the hijackers were so they would know where to mail the notes from? Well, we know the Israelis knew where the hijacker's cells were because they were living next door to them. The Mossad was living right next door to Mohammed Atta. But see, you're not going to hear any of this. You're not going to hear about this stuff if you're listening to Jonestown. They're just going to talk over and over about Building 7 and so on, which is a really horrible argument because they look at one side of the building and say, look, it's only got pockets of fire. No building ever fell from fire. And then you look at the other side of the building, it's absolutely on fire. The whole southwest corner is missing. That doesn't mean asymmetrical fires should cause a symmetrical collapse. But that's like a Class D argument. It's one of the lowest things you could do. It's almost irrelevant to the entire picture of 9/11. But all these 9/11 films, all they do is focus on how fast the buildings came down. And then a lot of them get into a bunch of ridiculous nonsense. That's all I'm going to say about that. But you cannot omit the Israeli role. Not in 9/11, not in the lies about 9/11, the anthrax, or the Iraq War. But that's exactly what Jonestown does. There's absolutely no way the Israelis could not have known about it at minimal. They were in on it. I would say they did it. And this isn't some nefarious, vague group. It's not the New World Order or the Bavarians or the Illuminati or the Luciferians or the Globalists or what have you, or criminal elements. It was the Israelis. And call a spade a spade. There are names and documents linking these individuals to Iraq, to anthrax, and to PNAC and 9/11. And that's why I can't stand Kosher Jones. He does so much damage by giving a microphone to every lunatic possible about 9/11 so that the issue will get conflated with a bunch of cuckoo conspiracies, and therefore you can't talk about the issue without coming out with a huge disclaimer, distancing yourself from the people that believe in aliens and missiles and all the other nonsense.
All right, Ryan. Well, we gotta shut her down here pretty soon, but if there's any last comments you want to make, wrap up everything, your vast knowledge of the events surrounding September 11th and the wars that followed. Just wrap it up.
That wasn't the only urban movings van pulled over. There was another one pulled over on the George Washington Bridge packed with RDX explosives, and that was reported on CBS, on CNN, on Fox. It was all over the news. It was all over the written news. And if you go back to the 93 World Trade Center bombing, there was a plan to blow up the Holland Tunnel with that. And Josie Hadass, a Mossad agent, was involved in that, as was the FBI. The FBI's own sting operation that never happened had built the bomb that they used. But anyway, I mean, 93, that's also in the film. I went over quickly the 93 World Trade Center bombing. But this is the most damning thing ever. They're caught with explosives on the bridge, red-handed. And Bernard Carrick, the police chief who just got out of jail, he went to jail for fraud, working with mobsters, got up on camera the next day with Giuliani and said, yes, they were arrested, but there weren't any explosives. Even though there were all these live reports, plus the police report itself, which is redacted, but you can still tell how by the length of it that they did find explosives, because it wouldn't be as long as it is if they hadn't, are there saying there's these bombs, and it's from an urban moving systems van. So it all goes back to Israel. They nearly blew up the bridge. And I think the phase two, which they never pulled off, was to hit the bridge or a target and blame it on the Palestinians. That way they've got Iraq and Palestine all packaged together, and the U.S. would go on its merry way to war. Well, they still went to war in Iraq. Hell, they're still dying in Iraq. There was no reason for the war in Iraq. But I have to stress to people that was not a war for oil. That was a war for Israel. The lies came from Israelis in the Pentagon and Israeli moles, their own journalists, Judas Miller, William Sapphire, the go-to Zionist hacks. Miller went to jail for 85 days for her role in the Plame affair. We don't have time to get into that. But that also involved Louis Libby and the Valerie Plame, Brewster Jennings and Associates. It's a big scandal. But once she got out of jail, She got hired again by Fox. It's just unbelievable.
Well, none of them get in trouble. That's how they control the narrative, right? They get their own people in there. But unfortunately, we're out of time. But I thank you so much for coming on and sharing with us your wealth of knowledge. And have to do it again sometime. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for giving me the platform. And there's just no way I can get it out all in a short interview. But I encourage people to go watch War by Deception on my site, or even buy a DVD, although it is free online. It's just, it helps me out so I can make the next documentary.
All right. Well, yeah, for sure. Check out Ryan's work. What's your website?
ancreport.com. That's anti-neocon. So just ancreport.com. And I've got a podcast up there. And, well, there's tabs on the top to find everything.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
All right. Have a good night.